Hello, and welcome to the Herb Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of the Digest. Herb Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It's our readers who support Herb Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. That's right, 2 months for free. In this world of information overload in which we all find ourselves living, Arab Digest keeps it simple. With one article a day and the weekly podcast, we provide unique coverage of the Middle East and North Africa, featuring the very best experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Essential reading, essential listening, and no overload. My guest today is Helen Lackner. Helen is a Yemen expert, a regular Arab Digest contributor, and the author of several books on the country. Her latest, published by Routledge, is titled Yemen, Poverty and Conflict. Helen, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, hello, Bill. Thank you so much for asking me again and for showing interest in Yemen.
My pleasure, and delighted to have you back. I want to talk about the Houthi Red Sea engagement, but before we get to that, can you just paint a picture for our listeners of the current military situation in Yemen? Who controls what, and what is the level of fighting right now between various factions?
Well, really, there's been very little change in that, basically, for the last 2 years, if not longer. Basically, the Houthis control the northern part of the west coast, of the Red Sea coast, halfway down between Hodeidah and Mocha. And they hold the central highlands and most of, basically, the highlands, including parts of Taiz and Ibb. And they don't hold the far east, which is both Hadramut and Marib. And there hasn't been much change. What has been happening and what has changed in the last few weeks is that the fighting on the fronts, which of the multiple fronts, which are always the same, has basically intensified somewhat in the last month or two. Previously, it was at a fairly steady low level, and now it's been intensified partly because thanks to the Red Sea operations, the Houthis have been recruiting, you know, massive numbers of people who have been coming to join their military forces. Mm. And so they've now got newly trained people whom they're having to deploy somewhere since they're clearly not going to get them up to Gaza. So they are now basically intensifying, and there is, you know, a lot of people seem to think they may well threaten some of the major positions, and particularly yet again try and get into Mareb.
That's been the kind of front line and a stalemate, as you said, over the past couple of years. But how much of the population, just to remind us, how much of the population is under Houthi control?
The vast majority of the population is under Houthi control. About 70% of the country's population are under Houthi control. They control basically the most of the highly populated rural areas, which are the, you know, which are the western highlands, and, you know, Sanaa and Hodeidah, which are two major cities, as well as a number of sort of medium-sized cities. So basically, the majority of the population lives under Houthi rule.
Mm. And I had this picture of the south separated out really from the Houthi controlled areas with different factions, again, contesting. Would that be the correct image to have?
No, not really. I think, you know, the standard description of the Houthis control the north and the others control the south is erroneous, partly because what it tends to assume is the north equals the former Yemen Arab Republic and the south equals the former British-controlled area or People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, which is simply incorrect because part of the area that's under non-Houthi control, for example, the southwest coast, the area from north of Mocha up to the Bab al-Mandab, part of the former YAR, but is controlled by Tariq Saleh, who is connected with the internationally recognized government. Maghreb and those areas in the east are also not part of the former PDRY. So, you know, it's a mistake to say north-south. I mean, I always try to say, you know, Houthi-controlled. And nowadays, given that the internationally recognized government is so divided, one tends to say the Houthi-controlled area and the anti-Houthi-controlled area.
Yeah. And the United Arab Emirates still a player in parts of the south, in Aden and Socotra, would that be right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Emirates are particularly active in supporting sections of what's known now as the Presidential Leadership Council, i.e. the official leadership of the anti-Houthi section. And that is composed, you know, the PLC is composed of 8 men. And of them, you know, approximately 4 are vaguely aligned with the Saudis, and the other 4 are much more closely aligned with the Emiratis. But the Emiratis are playing a fairly sophisticated role. So basically, they are supporting not just southern separatists, but they're also supporting the man I just mentioned a moment ago, Tarek Saleh, who is the nephew of ex-president Saleh, and who controls basically the Red Sea coast and the Bab al-Mandab area. He is definitely not a separatist. So they have a fairly sophisticated position, which allows them to, you know, maneuver maybe more effectively, I would say, than the Saudis at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move on now to the Houthis and the Red Sea theater. The Houthis have been the only actor, state or non-state, in the Arab world who have taken very open and direct action on behalf of the Palestinians. I'm just wondering, Helen, how strategic that decision was and how effective it has been.
Well, I'd say it's been both strategic and effective. I mean, it's not effective in the sense that it's directly impacting the situation in Gaza or indeed the Israeli activities in the region, because the Israelis are probably less impacted than certainly maritime international trade. And it's only, you know, one of their ports, Eilat, which has had a significant reduction in traffic. And so at that level, it has not been so, you know, it hasn't been directly impacting on the Gaza situation. But it has been very effective in terms of providing very serious international attention and drawing international attention, which it's always worth remembering. You know, both the US and the Brits and most others are talking about freedom of navigation in the Red Sea, etc., pretending that this has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. Which is very simply not the case. I think the Houthis would not have done this had the war in Gaza not happened. And until very recently, and I'd say up to a point up to today, they insist that if the war in Gaza ends, they will immediately stop these actions. And I think there's good reason to believe them when they say that. But it's been a major boost for them. I mean, nationally, it's boosted their popularity enormously at a time when it was really at a low ebb. I mean, it's not as if most people living under Houthi control are finding it a wonderful, you know, a wonderful way of life and think they are the best rulers in the world. It's rather the opposite. You know, they're very oppressive and it's a very unpleasant regime. But the Yemeni population as a whole, whether under Houthi rule or not, are very, very supportive of the Palestinian issue. And as a result, they are now much more supportive, at least of the Houthi actions in this respect, if not of, you know, Houthi daily management. And so they've received a massive boost. And as I was saying earlier, you know, thousands of young men are coming to join their military with the intention. And I don't want to say hope, but since, you know, hoping to go and get killed isn't really a very positive thing, but with the intention of actually doing something for Palestine. And so I think that's a really important element. The other important element, of course, as you know, those of us who attend the Palestine demos in England know on a regular basis, most people who attend those are now, many people are now praising the Houthis, people who 6 months ago wouldn't have known if the Houthi was some brand of food or something. They've massively improved their popularity nationally, and of course, far more so in the Arab and Muslim world, as well as beyond in our part of the world.
Yeah,
So it's been a great boost for them.
and we've seen these massive demonstrations too, haven't we, in Sana'a and in other cities
Yeah,
in Egypt.
absolutely. I mean, all the Friday demonstrations, are now incredibly well attended. And not only are they incredibly well attended, but I think they're incredibly well attended by people who genuinely want to be there, as opposed to being kind of told that you really ought to be there.
The Saudis, they're keen to get out of Yemen, and before the 7th of October, talks were moving along. But how has the Gaza war impacted on a peace deal for Yemen?
It's had a very considerable impact. I mean, the widespread belief was that an agreement, ending the Saudi involvement in Yemen, which would have taken the shape of a deal signed as participants by the internationally recognized government and the Houthis, witnessed and mediated by the Saudis and largely the Omanis, was about to be signed. Even up to December, people were talking about the preparations for some ceremony. This is now obviously impossible. The Saudis are extremely embarrassed because they absolutely want out. And what they really want is not just being out, which effectively they are, it's being seen to be out, see, being seen in public to be out. And that's why such a ceremony would have been incredibly useful. But, in the current situation, given the population of Saudi Arabia also being extremely pro-Palestinian, it's extremely difficult for them to say or do anything against the Houthis and against the Houthi actions in the Red Sea in particular. And so, I mean, you've seen it and we've all seen it, they've made appeals to the US and the UK to basically tone things down and keep things quiet and, not make things worse than they actually are, because it's just causing them serious embarrassment. So I think from their point of view, the peace deal in terms of a formal event is really out at the moment. What has happened is at the end of December, the UN special envoy announced that that everybody had agreed a roadmap and that he is trying to get it off the ground, basically. And various elements of this roadmap are the ones we've heard about for many, many times, which include basically a ceasefire, a serious, significant contribution by the Saudis to pay for salaries of Yemeni official government staff, even including military and security staff of the Houthis. And all kinds of other elements that are part of what the UN's been proposing forever. And he's trying to work and make progress on this without any kind of formal agreement and formal event to mark a change in the nature of a change in status, I suppose, of the war.
Does the U.S. designation of the Houthis as a terror group have an impact on the peace talks?
Absolutely, because that has a very significant impact. Because, assuming the agreement was made or is being implemented, or even without a formal agreement, should there be progress, one of the major elements is the Saudis financing, Yemeni government staff. Now, that's something which is going to be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, now that the Americans have designated the Houthis as, I forget what the terminology is. It's not a foreign terrorist organization. It's a specially designated terrorist group. I think,
That's it.
which is different from a foreign terrorist organization. And it's a slightly milder form of designation. But the point is that in terms of making financial transfers, I think, you know, given the way all financial institutions basically bow and scrape as soon as the Americans threaten anything, so that for the Saudis, you know, it would be very difficult for the Saudis to implement that element of the agreement. And that element of the agreement is extremely important, you know, for the Houthis as well as for the rest of the Yemenis.
Very interesting. Yet another complication in an already fiendishly complicated situation in Yemen. Let's look at the humanitarian situation. There's a great deal of concern, and quite rightly, with humanitarian disaster that's unfolding daily in Gaza. But what about Yemen and the humanitarian situation there, Helen? It's kind of been pushed to one side a bit by events in Gaza.
Yes, I think the humanitarian situation in Yemen is serious, and it continues to be serious and is actually worsening. But of course, it does not compare with, you know, mass starvation and death in Gaza, as you know, we're seeing on our televisions on a daily basis now. But it's still extremely serious. But it's also, you know, we have major problems of humanitarian support and humanitarian crisis in so many other countries that, you know, Yemen lost its status of being the worst. But again, not because of any improvement. So there are, you know, problems of arrival of products, of basic foods. And let's remember that Yemen is dependent on imports for 90% of its basic staples, i.e. rice, wheat and such like, tea and sugar and such like, though not for various, for other things like vegetables and fruit and meat. But the point is that the situation is grave and is worsening, and the amount of humanitarian support has reduced considerably and was last year, you know, 38% of the required amount. The amount that they've asked for this year is significantly less than it was. But as of now, and we're now already well into March, there hasn't yet been an announcement of when the pledging conference will take place. And the pledging conference is the moment when most states declare how much they are going to contribute. And again, you know, we are in a situation where calls for humanitarian aid, not just in Yemen, but in many other countries, is getting worse and more urgent and more desperate. And so I think the prospects, you know, for hunger and problems in Yemen this year are, you know, quite grave. And again, they don't compare with Gaza, but that doesn't mean that, you know, life is easy in any way there.
Now, this Friday, 8th of March, is International Women's Day. And in Yemen, women, as you've written about for us in their Digest newsletter, have borne much of the brunt of the war, which is now into its 10th year. Can you talk about the sort of challenges that women are facing in both that part of Yemen controlled by the Houthis and those areas outside Houthi control?
Yes, I think one of the interesting, you know, aspects of the situation anywhere in the world is looking at the status of women and how women are treated. It really gives a very good indication of the nature of the ruling regime or ruling clique or whoever they are. And interestingly, just yesterday, I think the Human Rights Watch have just produced another report on women in Yemen, which points out, you know, yet again, that women are treated very badly by all the factions concerned. So whether you're talking about the internationally recognized government, about the southern separatists or the Houthis, you know, women's movements have been seriously restricted. And increasingly, you know, it's more difficult for women to do anything without being, or to go anywhere without being accompanied by a male guardian, even if that male guardian is the 14-year-old son of a 50-year-old woman, as they quoted in the Human Rights Watch report. And that, you know, and in particular, that all the factions seem to be particularly aggressive and unpleasant to women who are working for in the humanitarian sector, which brings us back to what we were talking about a moment ago, which is the serious problems of the humanitarian sector and the difficulties, you know, making it more difficult for women to work in the humanitarian sector. That also means it's more difficult, for example, to distribute aid or to provide medical aid or to provide, you know, supplies to women and to women-headed households and even, you know, women who may have men in their family, but who are looking after the men. So it's basically, you know, but all these regimes are really acting, treating women as second-class citizens, if that. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, none of them are really showing any sign of providing the kind of regime that people would like to live under. And that is another, you know, very depressing feature in terms of the long run, of not seeing any prospect of improved living conditions under a future regime, i.e., who, you know, regardless of who ends up being in control of all of Yemen in the future, if that ever happens, you know, we're not talking about very, very uphill work with respect to human rights in general and to acceptable living conditions and equality for citizens, regardless of their sex or gender or whatever.
And is it the case that in these ongoing conversations, peace talks, that women are still marginalized, not much a part of that conversation, therefore women's rights are just not getting the examination and support they deserve?
Yes, I think the last time, which was, I think, about a year ago, if not longer, that there was an announcement of membership of a negotiating team. I think the internationally recognized government had included one or two women. But other than that, they usually have, you know, the UN has this effort and has different women's groups and women's organizations that they consult on a regular basis. But it's usually the case that when those women are asked their views, you know, they consider that they're still very, very much marginalized and that they're never part of any, you know, direct debate. Of course, there hasn't been any direct negotiations between the Houthis and the anti-Houthis now for quite some time. Certainly no indication of women being taken, of women's concerns and interests. And indeed, women's concerns also cover those of all the population. They tend to be much more, you know, concerned with the welfare of the population at large than men, who tend to be have much more narrow, politically directed, you know, concerns when discussions are taking place.
Yeah, and I was thinking too of that presidential council, no women sitting on that.
Absolutely none. No, I mean, they're basically mostly military leaders, except for the president, who doesn't have a military faction of his own.
Just coming back to the issue of the ceasefire, which, you know, is being discussed now in Cairo. And of course, Israel is playing this game about making further demands, which rather reminds me of the Houthis a bit. But anyway, should a longer-term ceasefire happen in Gaza, do you see that clearing the road to helping to bring peace in Yemen?
Well, I think the first point to be made is that it really doesn't look like this is likely to happen. I hope I'm wrong, but I have a strong suspicion that, you know, if there is no ceasefire, which does look to be the case at the moment in Gaza for Ramadan, I think that will be a very, very, very negative impact throughout the Middle East. You know, assuming that I'm wrong and that there is such a ceasefire, the big difference now with respect to Yemen is that if the US and the Brits hadn't started their airstrikes on Yemen, I would have said, yes, that would probably bring us back, and it would enable a ceremony to take place to formally end the Yemen war, which, again, I want to come back to that in a moment, because, you know, a deal that removes the Saudis from the war does not actually end the war. It leaves the war to where it would have been if the Saudis had never intervened, i.e., in basically the Yemeni conflict, the intra-Yemeni conflict remains and is still, you know, remains a very important element and has, you know, no prospect of solution. And now we're in a situation where the Houthis are in an even stronger position against the internationally recognized government or the Presidential Leadership Council or whoever in debates, because of, you know, all the status and the capacity they've gained in the last 3 months. I think, that's one element. But at the moment, assuming that something happened in Gaza, the problem would be, that we now have a new situation with the direct US and UK airstrikes on Yemeni territory. So, in 2022, Yemeni stopped suffering airstrikes from the Saudi-led coalition, i.e., mainly the Saudis and the Emiratis. And, now they're suffering airstrikes from directly from the US and the UK. And the Houthis are retaliating by having expanded their targeting in the Red Sea from Israeli-connected shipping to any US and UK-connected shipping. And indeed, the ship that just sank 2 days ago is a British-owned ship. And it's the first one that sunk. Let's also remember it's the first one that's been very seriously damaged. The Houthis are now openly at war against the US and the UK, which, of course, if you remember the Houthi slogan, US is their number one enemy. So whether they would stop now and whether the Americans and the Brits would stop now, I think is a question that I feel quite unable to answer, to be honest.
As I said earlier, it's a fiendishly complicated situation. And as you say, even with the Saudis getting out, which we know they desperately want to do, but the conflict, in all likelihood, what could continue, exacerbated by these British and American strikes on the Houthis?
I think it's a possibility. It's interesting to note that the Americans are now saying they don't actually know how much they've managed to degrade of the Houthi weaponry. And again, it's important to remember that, although the Houthis have now basically sunk one ship, and they've, marginally hit quite a number of others with a mostly not affecting their ability to continue their routes, as they said. But it's still an important element in the sense that all they need to do is threaten in terms of the impact on the traffic in the Red Sea, which is impacted in two ways, basically by expanding, increasing the cost of insurance and travel for those ships that continue to travel through the Red Sea, and of course, increase the cost for the ones who go around the Cape of Good Hope. So it's also important there to remember again that the Houthis have said it again, I think yesterday, that ships that announce that they have no connection with Israel, or now indeed Britain and the US, are allowed to travel without hindrance by the Houthis, but they have to basically now ask for Houthi permission to travel.
The Houthis, as you say, have been put in a much more powerful position than they were before 7th of October. Helen,
Sorry, there's just one more thing I think
you go
we
ahead.
do need to mention is the issue of, the Houthis. The Houthis' actions in the Red Sea and in support of Palestine are supported by the overwhelming majority of Yemenis. But it's important to remember that the internationally recognized government is now actually asking the US and the UK to increase their involvement. Now, they haven't, as far as I know, openly asked for them to bring troops into Yemen, but they have explicitly asked for more air support. They've explicitly asked for more weaponry. They've explicitly asked for more technical support. They are actually asking the US and the UK to be more active in supporting them towards the defeat of the Houthis. And I mean, that, should it happen, and again, I have absolutely no idea whether either the US or the UK are likely to accept these suggestions, but should they happen, would be a major, major escalation of the war in Yemen, which would make the 2015 to 2022 Saudi Emirati episode look a bit like a piece of rehearsal, really.
Oh boy,
So
oh
that
boy.
would be an extremely dangerous and unfortunate development.
Yeah, indeed, and particularly for the Yemeni people.
Absolutely.
Let's leave it there and hope that that does not become a reality in this increasingly difficult and challenging region of the world. Helen, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Bill, and hoping I'm wrong. I like to hope I'm wrong.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was the Yemen expert Helen Lackner. Helen is the author of several seminal studies on Yemen. Her latest, published by Routledge, is Yemen, Poverty and Conflict. I can't recommend it highly enough. You'll have noticed that we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free two-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators, and writers, contributors like Helen. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and search our library of over 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thanks for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest. Essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.